I completed my residency in OBGYN at Georgetown University Hospital, and now I am a fellow in a specialty called pediatric and adolescent gynecology at Baylor in Houston, Texas. Those are my qualifications. As far as our agreements, we will kind of briefly go through these, as I think everyone should be familiar by now, but old friend mentality, meaning just treating everyone like an old friend, break it down. So if you use jargon or another language, to just explain it in simple terms in English. Don't yuck my yum, meaning, you know, just appreciate that people will like or enjoy things that maybe you don't, you know, that you're not into. We're all at different places, so everyone's on their own journey. Step up, which is my favorite one, meaning if you don't normally speak up, please feel free to speak up and step back. So if you're someone who normally speaks up, giving, you know, the mic to somebody else, and then you do you. So just be authentic. There will be no link sharing in the chat. I assume the best intent of people, but acknowledge if something is harmful or if something is really off, feel free to email me. Be present. So if you're able to name yourself with your, at least your first name, show your video if you can, speak from your experience, no recording from the participant side, but the video will be recorded and put onto Swiss. And then just get comfortable. So settle down, light some candles, grab a hot tea, and we'll go ahead and get started. All right, so the objectives for today are as follows. First, we're going to describe the stages of development of an embryo and a fetus, and kind of what the difference between those two things are. Correlate those stages of development with Quranic and Hadith descriptions of the developing human. Discuss the concept of ensoulment, meaning the moment that the soul enters into the body of the fetus, and the Islamic principles used to delineate the beginning of human life. And then understand the fiqh rulings around vaginal bleeding related to miscarriage and a little bit related to postpartum bleeding. And then discuss the Islamic principles and legal rulings around pregnancy terminations, which are another way of saying abortions. Any questions about that so far? Okay. So conception, how does an egg meet a sperm? So the egg is released from the ovary. And first I'll just give you a breakdown of what this image is. Sorry if it's a little bit graphic, but imagine that someone is kind of sliced in half at the level of the belly button and you're looking down into the pelvis. So this is the bladder. This is the last part of the large intestine before the stool comes out. And then in between these two structures, you have the uterus, okay? And then coming off the uterus are the fallopian tubes here that have kind of the little springy looking ends. And then the ovaries on either side, okay? So every month there are several hundreds of thousands of follicles within the ovaries that are developing, and one of them eventually will become an egg, and that egg will, ovulation is when that egg ruptures from the capsule of the ovary, and it gets released actually into this space behind the uterus. So in this diagram, everything is kind of lifted up, but imagine that if all of this were kind of like sunk back, these ovaries would be tucked under here with the fallopian tube surrounding them. And actually the egg gets released into this area along with a little bit of fluid. And it's from that fluid that either the right or the left fallopian tube can pick up that egg. And these fimbriae, which is I think a Latin term for fingers, actually scoop up the egg and deposit it into the tube itself, okay? So because that egg is just floating in this little puddle of fluid, can actually be grabbed from either side, regardless of whether it ovulates from the right or the left ovary. And so once the egg gets into the tube, there needs to actually be firm sperm present in the tube at the time of ovulation, because the ovum is actually very unstable. It is not even a complete cell, right? It only has the genetic material for really half of the cell. So if sperm are present in the ovary, then fertilization happens, and it happens typically within an hour of ovulation, so pretty fast. And then eventually what happens is that this fertilized egg starts going down the fallopian tube. So you start off with your ovum, which is half your genetic information from your mom, the sperm, which is half the genetic information from the dad, and when these two combine, they form something called a zygote. This is initially one cell, and then it starts to double. So from one cell, you get two cells. Those two cells will each double to get four cells and then eight cells. And when you get to the 16-cell stage, is when you have something called a morula. And that is a Latin term meaning mulberry-like, kind of describing the shape of it. And around day three after fertilization, the morula is going to enter the uterus, okay? It's going to continue to divide. And when it gets to be about 60 cells, it becomes something called a blastocyst. What kind of distinguishes the blastocyst is that it has this cavity here. And so on one side of the cavity, you have a group of cells called the inner cell mass. These are what are going to go on to become the developing embryo and then fetus. And then this other end of the blastocyst is called the trophoblast. The name doesn't really matter, but ultimately this becomes the placenta. Okay, so around 6 days after fertilization, this blastocyst is going to implant into the lining of the uterus. Does anyone have any questions about those things so far? Okay. So the critical question at this point is, how do you calculate the age of a pregnancy? And what's important to understand is the difference between something called an embryologic age versus something called a gestational age. And it's very critical that you understand kind of the difference between these two things and how you can maybe use one to derive the other in order to understand the FIC rulings around abortion and, of course, when life begins, right? So this is a diagram that you've seen. If you've seen either my first or second lecture, it's basically a diagram of the menstrual cycle, but to includes if a conception were to occur. So the menstrual cycle is based on the timing of the period. So day one of the menstrual cycle is going to be day one of bleeding. And so bleeding occurs for the first few days of the cycle. Eventually it stops. The lining of the uterus starts to build up. And then at about the halfway mark for a menstrual cycle, so let's say that the cycle is 28 days, which is the average, ovulation would occur, okay? And ovulation, you can think of in this case as being synonymous with fertilization because they happen within an hour of each other, right? So your embryologic age starts from the moment that the sperm meets the egg at the time of ovulation, which would be around day 14. And in the sacred tradition, this is the method that's used to describe the development of the pregnancy, okay? Your gestational age starts from day one of the last menstrual period. So if you have ever been pregnant, or inshallah, if you get pregnant one day, then when you go to the doctor and they tell you the age of the pregnancy, what they're giving you is this number calculated from day one of your period. So this is a method used by OBs to track pregnancies. So basically a simple way to calculate between your gestational age to the embryologic age is that the gestational age equals the embryologic age plus 14 days. So you have to account for those 14 days prior to when ovulation occurred, ovulation slash conception. So basically, if you think of the day of ovulation as day zero, your embryologic age, according to the gestational age, you've already been pregnant for 2 weeks in a sense, right? And so if you were to look at the day that the morula implants, for example, we know that it implants 6 days after ovulation slash fertilization. So your embryologic age would be 6 days because that's 6 days after conception occurred, but the gestational age would actually be 20 days. So the pregnancy at this point would be considered to be about 2 weeks and 3 days, okay? So not a very difficult calculation, but why is it that providers will use the gestational age? It's simply because it's easier. It's actually really hard to determine the exact day of ovulation because there isn't like a little light bulb that goes off or any kind of external sign that happens that tells you, hey, I'm ovulating, right? And so it would, the easiest thing to do is just base it off of the period because every woman can tell you which day she first started to have bleeding, right? Any questions about the difference between these two things?
I have a question. I'm Sabrina, by the way.
Oh, Sabrina, hey, okay.
There's the thing called the due date fallacy, if I'm not mistaken, where the push and pull between birthing women and their providers when they are being pushed for inductions and whatnot, and uh-huh. they feel like their body isn't ready, even though that is technically already 39 weeks and 40 weeks. And I know like the World Health Organization recommends to give birthing moms time up until 42 weeks. That's like the most. That is it because of this as well? Like the whole, like between 40 to 42 weeks, there's this leeway?
So that's a really interesting question. I guess from the perspective of the World Health Organization or from like any provider who's caring for someone with a pregnancy, they actually never, ever, ever, excuse me, think of the pregnancy in terms of the embryologic age. The data that they're basing, or the reason why they're making those recommendations is because of data that they have on what the outcomes are for babies who go to certain gestational ages. So the gestational age is 240 days from that first, from the first day of your last period, which equals about 40 weeks. And to be honest, it's in some ways, it's kind of like arbitrary whether they were to use an embryologic age or a gestational age, but ultimately they stick to one, which is the gestational age. And then they say that babies who are in utero for more than 2 weeks beyond their due date have a much higher risk of stillbirth. And so that is where that recommendation comes from.
Oh, I see, okay.
Thank you. Does that make sense? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Anyone else? Okay. So descriptions in the Quran of conception and embryogenesis from Surat al-Mu'mineen. We have, and indeed we created man from a draught of clay, then we made him a drop in a secure dwelling place. So elsewhere in the Quran, humans are described as being created from dried clay, made of molded mud, a base fluid, or dried clay like earthen vessels. And then there are many other references simply to clay. So the drop here refers to seminal fluid. And I think that is also what the base fluid would refer to. And then the secure dwelling place is the womb, okay? And just as an FYI, this commentary comes from the study Quran, if you have it. And then the rest of the surah says, then of the drop, we created a blood clot. Then of the blood clot, we created a lump of flesh. Then of the lump of flesh, we created bones and we clothed the bones with flesh. Then we brought him into being as another creation. Blessed is God, best of creators. So in these verses, you have a somewhat vivid description of what the development is like within the uterus. You go from a blood clot to a lump of flesh to a lump of flesh with bones. And then eventually brought into a being as another creation, so becoming a human. So this verse is paired with the following hadith, and from it, scholars extrapolate the age of ensoulment. So in this hadith, it says, your creation is such that you are brought together in your mother's belly for 40 nights. Then you are a blood clot for the same duration, 40 nights, then a lump of flesh of the same duration, 40 nights. And then God sends an angel who is given commands regarding four things, and thus he writes down one's provision, one's deeds, one's lifespan, and whether one will be wretched or joyous, okay? So let's break that down. In that hadith, it says that for 40 days, you're a blood drop, a drop, a drop of seminal fluid, for example. And then for another 40 days, a blood clot, another 40 days, a lump of flesh. And then after that 40-day period ends, so at the 120-day mark, everything about what happens for the rest of your life is written. And so that is considered the time of ensoulment, meaning the time that the soul enters the body. But remember that this is the embryonic age. This is not the age that's assigned by a provider. So you can't use these numbers. You have to use your conversion. So by 120 days, scholars from all schools unanimously agree that ensoulment has taken place, okay? So in gestational age, what would that be? So from 0 to 7 weeks and 5 days, it would be a drop. From 7 weeks until 13 weeks and 3 days, a blood clot. And then at 19 weeks and 1 day, after that becomes a lump of flesh, and then this is the point at which ensoulment occurs. And so now we want to know, what is the embryo actually doing at these points of development? What do we know medically about what happens at each of these points? Does anyone have any questions about like these conversions or what like these number cutoffs mean? Okay. So trimesters are calculated based on gestational age, not embryologic age. And as we said, the human gestation is 40 weeks long. So the first trimester goes from the first day of last menstrual period until 13 weeks and 6 days, basically, you know, until about 14 weeks. The pregnancy is an embryo from 5 to 10 weeks and is considered a fetus from 11 weeks onward. And we'll talk about the difference between these two. And the second trimester starts at 14 weeks. And then it's during the second trimester that you pass the 19 week and 1 day mark. And this is the time that scholars agree that ensoulement has occurred. And then the third trimester would be 28 weeks until delivery. Okay. So gestational age milestones. So at around week 4, the pregnancy is the size of a pinhead. And then by week 5, the pregnancy is considered an embryo. The brain, spine, and heart are beginning to form. And this is the critical period that birth defects can occur. And most of these defects actually have no known cause, okay? But this is also the earliest that the pregnancy could be seen on an ultrasound. So if you look at this week 5 ultrasound, what this is generally showing is this structure. Are you guys able to see my mouse?
Yep.
Oh yeah, awesome. So this structure is the uterus. This kind of slightly brighter colored, you know, more white area is the lining of the uterus. And then here's the pregnancy implanted. And all you can see is what we call the gestational sac, and you can't really see any of the other structures within it. And then by week 6, the pregnancy grows to the size of a dime. And this is the earliest that a fetal heartbeat can be detectable. And at this point, you can actually measure the size of the fetus based on the crown rump length. So going from the tip of the head to the spine. So if you look here, now our gestational sac is much bigger. It's this entire black area. This is the yolk sac from which the embryo is actually deriving its nutrients until the placenta is more developed. And then this is the developing human. And what they're measuring here, the CRL or the crown rump length, just going from the tip of the head into the base of the spine. Okay, so the pregnancy, the day of the last period alone is usually, the day of the last period is not usually used alone to determine the timing of the pregnancy. They'll combine that with the crown rump length and see, depending on if they're close enough together, then they'll go based on the last period, or if they're too far off and we have, you know, different number cutoffs depending on the gestational age, then they may actually redate the pregnancy based on what they see on ultrasound. Also because some women's periods are irregular, so the time of the last period may not always be reflective of how old the pregnancy is. By week 7, the pregnancy becomes the size of a nickel, and then this is where we hit those first 40 days that's described in the hadith. So that's the first 40 days embryologic age, which corresponds to 7 weeks, 5 days gestational age. And so the pregnancy is no longer considered a blood clot and has now become a lump of flesh, okay? By week 8, the pregnancy is the size of a quarter. And then by week 10, the embryonic tail disappears. And that is when the pregnancy becomes a fetus. So the every human, while it's developing in the uterus, will initially have this tail, and then eventually the tail just is kind of broken down. And it's at that point that the pregnancy becomes a fetus. And also it is at this point that the pregnancy is now discernible as a human. So fingerprints are being formed and the pregnancy is about 1 inch long. So this is an ultrasound of a 10-week-old fetus. By week 11, the fetus can open its mouth and swallow. And then by week 12, the uterus has grown enough that it can be actually felt through the abdomen just above the level of the pubic bone, okay? So week 13 is really interesting. We no longer use the crown rump length to measure the fetus. At this point, we can actually use something that we call fetal biometry, meaning that we take measurements from the hard bony structures. So we would measure both the circumference of the head as well as the diameter of the head, or the skull rather. So imagine that we were measuring the circumference here and also the diameter of the skull. And then we also measure the circumference of the abdomen going around this way, and then the length of the femur, which is the long bone of the thigh. and all of these structures become evident. And now if the pregnancy hasn't already been dated, these are the different measurements that your provider would obtain in order to help date the pregnancy. This corresponds with the second 40-day period that's described in the HEDI. So now we're at the 80 days or 13 weeks and 3 days gestational age, where the fetus is no longer a lump of flesh, but now a lump with bones. And subhanAllah, that's exactly what we're doing as providers, is now we're actually using the bones to measure the fetus. It was really fascinating. So in week 14 is when the second trimester begins. The fetus is now 3 inches long, and then the external genitalia can be seen on ultrasound at this point. You can determine if it's a boy or a girl. Week 15, the fetus is 6.5 inches long. It now weighs 4 ounces, or about the size of a deck of cards. And then in week 19, we reach the end of that third described 40-day period. So this would be the 120 days or 19 weeks of 1 day gestational age, where the Quran says that this is no longer just a lump with bones. It's now a lump with bones covered with flesh. And this is when ensoulment occurs. So around this time, we typically do it around 20 weeks. Certainly it can be done at around 19 weeks. Your provider is going to recommend an anatomy ultrasound to evaluate for fetal anomalies, just to make sure that all of the anatomy looks normal. And I included these ultrasounds to show you the level of depth at which we can actually detect every structure in the fetus, just like you would be able to see it, for example, on an MRI in an adult human, right? So this is the brain. We can see structures like the thalamus, the hippocampus. This is an ultrasound detailing different portions of the heart. So we can see the ascending aorta, the pulmonary artery, the aorta as it comes down, and the descending aorta. And then here, this is an ultrasound showing you the liver, the gallbladder. It's kind of cut off, but the stomach would be just underneath here. So even as the Quran describes that it is the fetus is now covered with flesh, then that is also the time at which we actually look at all of the fleshy structures within the fetus in order to check for any kind of anomaly in the stages of development. And it lines up, like, subhanAllah, like basically exactly, right? It's really interesting. So week 21, the fetus can suck, grasp, and have hiccups. And at week 22, it's now 11 inches long and weighs around 1 pound. So the question is, well, if ensoulment occurs at 19 weeks, then is it possible for a fetus to survive if it's born at 19 weeks? Let's say someone goes into preterm labor for whatever reason, survive. And the answer is no. And the age of viability refers to the age at which the fetus could survive outside the womb. And to be honest, it's actually partially dependent on a NICU's capabilities. So a NICU, you know, in a first world country where you have like all kinds of access to medicine, is going to be able to keep a fetus alive if it's born early better than one in which there aren't as many resources, right? So typically we refer to the age of viability as 24 weeks. As the NICU's capabilities have improved in the United States, at least, we're actually able to say that 23 weeks is periviable. So at 23 weeks, the survivability of the fetus is about 33%, meaning about 1 in 3 babies born at 23 weeks will survive. And then that number drastically jumps to 65% at 24 weeks. What's the reason for that? That's because the surface area of the lung significantly expands and the fetus is able to exchange oxygen in its lungs. So even though at 19 weeks, we're able to see all those organs and see that they're fully formed and, you know, theoretically should be functional, the issue is that the lungs just aren't able to exchange oxygen. The fetus cannot breathe very easily on its own, okay? But every week that the fetus stays in utero helps to increase the survivability until eventually you get to 32 weeks when that number approaches 100. And at 32 weeks, the fetus's lungs not only have expanded in surface area, but it's able to produce enough of a substance called surfactant to actually prevent the lungs from collapsing. So not only is there enough space for the oxygen to exchange, the lungs stay inflated. Just to put into context what the, you know, what is the meaning of the viability, because it's not exclusively about, you know, whether the baby's alive or not, but is this baby actually going to be able to like fully function? So at 23 weeks, unfortunately, only 2% of fetuses not only survive, but also have no further deficits. And then that number slowly starts to increase as the fetus is able to develop more in utero. What do we mean by major deficits? So there are certain issues that happen with premature infants. One of these things can be strokes. Another can be that the retina is not fully developed. So they develop something called retinopathy of prematurity, where they can't see fully. They can develop infections and get sepsis. And then a really serious form of that would be something called necrotizing enterocolitis, where basically they have a really bad bacterial infection of the GI tract. Okay, so sorry, I'm trying not to be very bleak, but I just want people to have an understanding of kind of like what exactly is happening, what these milestones mean. But then when you enter the third trimester, then you get to week 34, the fetus is about 18 inches and weighs 5 pounds. And this is typically the earliest age at which a pregnancy might be delivered due to severe pregnancy complications. So that could be something like really severe preeclampsia would probably be one of the more common reasons why we deliver women early. And certainly there are a number of reasons why a baby might be delivered early, either because of the health of the mother or because the thought is that the baby might actually survive better outside of the womb than inside. So for example, if someone's water bag of water were to break early, if it were to break at 34 weeks, at that point, it's actually considered safer to deliver the baby than to risk getting an infection in utero and trying to keep the pregnancy inside the uterus longer. At week 37, that's 3 weeks before the due date, it's no longer considered preterm. At 39 weeks, the infant is full term for anyone who wants to be delivered just as an elective delivery, meaning that for whatever reason, they just either don't want to be pregnant anymore or the timing kind of works out better in their lives. 39 weeks or a week before your due date would be the earliest age that you can just opt for delivery, either a vaginal delivery or a C-section, depending on the circumstance. At week 40, this is the due date that's given to the patient. It's calculated based on the last period, like we said. And then week 41 is post-term. So as Sabrina had mentioned earlier, we really start to recommend at 41 weeks. And if delivery doesn't occur at 41 weeks, then we recommend fetal monitoring, meaning that the patient has to come back to the OB clinic routinely, usually a couple of times a week, just to make sure that the fetus is still doing okay. And then certainly by 42 weeks, the recommendation is to be delivered. Does anyone have any questions about any of that so far? This is kind of a summary slide in case anyone wants to screenshot it, but just has the most important dates up top or kind of outlined. But any questions, thoughts?
I want to ask.
Yeah.
When do moms get I guess what's the risk and also benefits of steroid shots, I think, to mature the baby's lungs in the womb? Like how can you tell if someone's gonna go into preterm labor?
Oh my gosh, that is such a great question. So subhanAllah, we actually, as much as we've done research and, you know, as like we have all these incredible medical technologies, we are still actually so, so bad at predicting like preterm deliveries or whether or not someone is like truly going into labor or if they're just having preterm contractions. And I think part of that is because it's really hard to do ethical studies on pregnant people. And certainly no one's going to consent, for example, to like getting a biopsy of their uterus, like while they're pregnant or, you know, while they're going through a really difficult time in their lives, if they're, you know, having a preterm delivery and that sort of thing. But I also think that there's just so much of this that just can't be controlled. And it's really just in God's hands. But as far as for the steroid shot, we typically recommend it around the age of viability. So most people would recommend it if, for example, your bag of water breaks at 24 weeks, certainly, then the steroid shot is going to be recommended. and or if someone is having preterm contractions and there's some concern that they may deliver within the next 48 hours, then they would be given steroid shots. The reason why we don't do it earlier than 23 or 24 weeks is because if the baby has such a low chance of survival before that, then it's not really, I don't know how to say this. It's just, there's really no added benefit in getting a steroid shot, but the steroid shot can be given up until 36 weeks and 6 days. As I said on the last slide, 37 weeks means you're no longer preterm. So if you're preterm, you're eligible for it. And in certain instances, you're even eligible for it twice. Like, let's say there was one point where they thought you might go into preterm labor and they gave you the shot. And then depending on how much time has gone by and the timing of the first shot, then you may even be eligible for a second shot if they think you're, if you didn't go into labor the first time, but they think you might be going into labor the second time. Or if there is an intention to deliver the baby prematurely because, you know, let's say mom was diagnosed with a cancer and needs chemotherapy and we really need to deliver the baby so that she can expedite getting chemotherapy, for example. Then if they know that they're going to be planning a delivery within the next couple of days, then they'll provide the shots as well. And what Sabrina's referring to is a steroid shot that is given to the mom that actually helps the baby's lungs mature a little bit faster so that they have a better shot at being able to breathe once they're delivered. That's a really good question. Did I answer it for you?
Yes, thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. So let's talk a little bit about miscarriages. So miscarriage is a pregnancy loss that happens in the first trimester, or it's often defined as less than 13 weeks gestational age. It is actually very common. So occurs, some places will say 10% of clinically recognized pregnancies, meaning pregnancies that, you know, an OBGYN confirmed, you know, was a pregnancy on an ultrasound, let's say, but we really think it's actually up to 1 in 4 pregnancies. So imagine like back in the day when people were having like 8 or 10 kids, then they probably had 1 or 2 miscarriages like in the mix of those, okay? So 50% of miscarriages are due to fetal chromosomal abnormalities. What does that mean? We have this diagram here that shows oogenesis refers to how an egg is made. And essentially you have your human genetic data that has to duplicate and then separate and then separate again. And so at some point in this process, typically at the point where they're trying to separate out, these chromosomes don't divide out the way that they should be. So imagine if this cell had 2 blue chromosomes, or if it was missing and only had 1 red one, for example. And so these happen randomly. There's nothing that anyone can do to, you know, a medicine you can take to prevent it or something you can do to encourage them to divide the right way, okay? It just occurs randomly. And 50% of miscarriages are just because these don't have the proper amounts of genetic material in the ovum. As far as recurrent miscarriages, meaning 2 consecutive miscarriages, so 2 in a row, are relatively rare, about 1 in 5% of women. So 85% of women will have a normal pregnancy following 1 miscarriage, and 75% of women will have a normal pregnancy following 2 or more miscarriages. So I think one thing that we don't talk a lot about in the Muslim community is, or really probably in any community, is miscarriage. I think a lot of women feel, they may feel that they've kind of failed as a woman, or they have anxiety about whether or not they can have a normal pregnancy again in the future. And I think because people don't talk about it so much, we really don't realize how common it is. And, you know, having 1 miscarriage doesn't mean that you can never get pregnant again, or that you would need infertility services to get pregnant. It's actually your best chance at getting pregnant is to start trying again immediately after the first miscarriage. But does anyone have any questions, thoughts, like personal stories, anything they want to point out about this before we move on?
I miscarried at 9 weeks for my first pregnancy. Mm. And it was thanks to me passing that, I'm not sure, is it a fetus? Is it like at 9 weeks?
At 9 weeks, it's still an embryo.
Okay, so
this is a really good question. Yeah.
The embryo and also the lump of flesh that came with it. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah. So It was thanks to those crampings that I prepared for birth, you know, for with my second pregnancy, yeah, because it was the same, you know, contraction, it was the same, you know, kind of pain, so that was how soon after a miscarriage can you try again, like most some providers doctors, say like after 3 months?
Most doctors will want to just make sure that your beta HCG, your pregnancy hormone level, drops back down to zero, and some people don't even care to do that. As long as there is no concern that you had an ectopic pregnancy, for example, like a pregnancy that implanted somewhere where it shouldn't have been, there's really, you can start trying to get immediately. Really, like, no medical reason why you would need to wait. Just as long as you're not bleeding anymore, certainly. But otherwise, if you're no longer bleeding and there's and the pregnancy was known to have been in the uterus to begin with, or that they don't see anything in the uterus anymore, like on ultrasound, then it's okay to go ahead and start. That's a really good question. Anyone else?
No questions right now, but this is all very, very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so let's, this is another description in the Quran of conception embryogenesis. So this was in Surah Al-Hajj. It says, O mankind, if you are in doubt concerning the resurrection, remember we created you from dust, then from a drop, then from a blood clot, then from a lump of flesh formed and unformed, that we may make clear for you, and we cause what we will to remain in the wombs for a term appointed. Then we bring you forth as an infant, that then that you may reach maturity. And so the drop here again refers to semen, which is also mentioned in other parts of the Quran, such as the references to base fluid. And the lump of flesh formed and unformed is generally thought to mean that after the blood clot settles in the womb, so when the morula implants, some pregnancies come to term while others miscarry before producing fully formed human beings. So not only is it about the, you know, the fact that the pregnancy can be described as formed and unformed, but also in combination with this next line, we cause what we will to remain in the wombs for a term appointed, meaning that some pregnancies will come to term and some won't. And this is purely up to Allah. And subhanAllah, there's actually virtually like, there's really not much that your provider can do if the pregnancy is going to miscarry. There isn't like a magic medicine that you can take. And they even do studies on, for example, women who are going into preterm labor, if there are certain medications we can give them to stop the contractions. And even medicines that have been shown to stop the contractions cannot actually stop labor. If it is meant to be, it is meant to be, subhanAllah. And it's something that, like, as human beings, like, as advanced as our technology and our medicine is, we have not found a way to be able to change that. And I just think it's actually so reassuring to see in the Quran this recognition of like something that can actually be like a big tragedy for a person or for a couple or a family, like to have miscarried, but it's actually recognized as something that happens in the Quran and that it's in Allah's control alone. And I actually really like this verse for that reason. Does anyone have any thoughts about this? Okay. So fiqh rulings on miscarriage. I'm going to do a little terminology refresher. If you've seen my first lecture, then you've heard more detail about these words. But menstrual bleeding is, per the fiqh, vaginal bleeding that is between 3 to 10 days long and occurs around the time that you would expect your period to occur. Lochia is bleeding through the vagina after delivering a baby. Per the fiqh, it can last up to 40 days. And actually, as OBGYNs, we tell patients after they deliver, 6 weeks after delivery, you may continue to have bleeding. And 6 weeks is 42 days. So it's virtually the same as what's recognized by the fiqh scholars. Istihada is vaginal bleeding that does not meet criteria for either menstrual bleeding or lochia. That's kind of a really simple way of putting it. So any kind of vaginal bleeding that's not either of those first two. So if a miscarried fetus shows any human features, for example, fingers, hand, hair, then the bleeding is considered lochia, and you would treat it like postpartum bleeding, meaning that you can expect it to last up to 40 days, and then you wouldn't perform your prayers for those 40 days. And that typically occurs at 10 weeks gestational age is when you start to see those human features, because that's the time where it's no longer an embryo and now a fetus. But bleeding after a miscarried embryo, i.e. the stage before any discernible human features, is not lochia. And then you would treat it as menstrual bleeding, which means that you would expect it to not last more than 10 days. It may, in some instances, also be stehada. There's like a big asterisk there. There's a lot of information that you would need to know as far as what your last period was before that and the duration of bleeding, that sort of thing. So the simple way of putting it is that you can either treat it as menstrual bleeding or estehada, but you would need to know some of the other facts surrounding the bleeding in order to call it that. But the big thing is that it's not lochia either way. Any questions? Okay. So the FIC rulings on miscarriage. So a miscarried fetus, meaning a pregnancy that has human features, is named, it's washed, it's wrapped in a clean cloth, but it's not shrouded, meaning that it's not dressed for burial. And then it's buried, but it is not prayed for, prayed over. And then you would also take the placenta, umbilical cord, and the amniotic sac and wrap those in cloth and bury those as well. An embryo that has no discernible human features, there is no need to observe any religious liturgy. So you don't need to treat it the same way that you would treat a miscarried fetus. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. So how is abortion like approached in Islam? So the debate over abortion as a whole begins with the discussion of when life begins. So we talked about the significance of the 120 days and that being the time that ensoulment occurs. But there are some scholars that say that actually they divide it up based on whether it's before the 40 days or before the 120 day mark. So during the first 40 days, meaning that 7 weeks, 5 days gestational age, the majority of scholars would permit abortion for what they call legitimate reasons, meaning that the person feels that they're either physically or mentally unable to raise a child. So for example, that could be someone who maybe is, you know, much older and didn't think that they could get pregnant and they already had a few kids, let's say, and they just don't feel that they would be able to, you know, put in the amount of care that maybe a newborn would need or keep up with like a toddler, use as an example. But fear of poverty does not qualify as a justification, okay? And then two spouses must also be in agreement. So the reason why we say that poverty or the fear of it does not qualify is from this verse in the Quran that says, do not kill your children for fear of poverty. We provide for you and for them. And I wanna focus on this verse for a moment because I just find it really fascinating that the word that's used is often translated as poverty, but if you look, the word in Arabic is imlaq, and it's actually the fear of losing material wealth. Okay, so this isn't a verse that's necessarily designated towards poor people or people who have less means to say, oh, you know, just because, I mean, certainly, as we said, you shouldn't necessarily say that you don't have enough means to take care of a child, but actually this, you can think of it as being directed towards someone who actually is of a lot of wealth, who has a lot of wealth and still says, well, I don't know, because children are expensive and I saved all this money and I'm going to spend all this money on this kid. And subhanAllah, what you actually see in practice in the real world is that it's often people who have no means or countries that, let's say on a GDP level, are actually very poor, who have a lot of kids and appreciate kids and see kids as a blessing and have no like financial qualms with, you know, like the finances were never an issue or never something that they thought about or necessarily made them want to not have kids. But then you actually see people from the richest countries in the world with the highest GDPs, with, you know, individuals with the highest income who say, oh, I don't know if I can really afford a kid. So I'm not trying to call out any, you know, one individual, but when you look at it on in a global way, you actually see that that's what happens, is that it's actually that people will choose not to have kids either through, you know, the use of lifelong birth control or through the use of abortion to not have a kid. Whereas people who don't come from countries that have a lot of means, that's never something that factors in to their decision to have a kid. Does anyone have any thoughts about that? Okay. So many contemporary scholars will offer spiritual counsel to those considering a pre-40-day abortion. And so the way that counseling typically goes is that they encourage the couple to continue with the pregnancy unless there's already a known danger to the mother or the fetus. But of course, they still leave the door open to those who may choose otherwise. So what would be like a danger to the mother or fetus? Let's say this is someone who has already had 5 C-sections, and each C-section gets considerably more complicated than the previous one just because of the scarring, and you're, you know, continuing to operate on this organ over and over again, the uterus. So in that case, it may be wise to choose to end that pregnancy at this point, because you already know that there's a potential risk to the mother's life. So this is a quote from Dr. Hatem El-Hajj. She's a PhD in comparative fiqh and is also a board certified pediatrician. And so he said that abortion in the first 48 days of pregnancy upon mutual agreement of both parents is permissible for a legitimate cause, such as the woman's fear of not having the capacity to raise a newborn. And having said that, it's always preferable to avoid that. And if one relies on Allah's help and puts his or her trust in him, he will not let them down. So certainly there's a lot of uncertainty that goes with having a pregnancy, but in general, the Islamic stance is generally that it's encouraged and that there really should be a legitimate reason. And certainly that's considered on a case-by-case basis. And there's always the opportunity to speak with scholars to determine whether or not, you know, your fear or your hesitation is legitimate, right? So long as it's not a fear of poverty. But then after those 7 weeks and the abortion can be permitted up until 120 days when a pressing need is present. So an extreme fetal deformity that's incompatible with life, or for example, in the case of rape or incest, or maybe it's not, realized that the person is pregnant until later. So as we had discussed before, it's around, you know, that 19, 20 weeks that the anatomy ultrasound is performed when the provider can see if there are any extreme deformities that are noted, and the patient can be counseled as far as, you know, how likely is it that this baby would survive outside of the womb. You know, for example, there are some fetuses that they just don't develop kidneys, otherwise structurally fine, but just no kidneys. And in such a case, the pregnancy can survive to full term because it's reliant on the placenta and mom's system to kind of get rid of toxins that the kidneys would normally do, but that baby would not survive very long outside of the womb. And in such a case, it may be better to end the pregnancy early than to go all the way to full term, which can be associated with greater blood loss and more complications for mom to go through with a delivery, you know, much later in the pregnancy when it's known that the baby will not survive for very long. And certainly every kind of fetal anomaly is different, and the person should be counseled as far as like reasonable expectations for what could happen after the pregnancy. So by 120 days from conception, the scholars of all schools unanimously agree that ensoulment has taken place, and aborting the pregnancy would be forbidden after those 120 days as the embryo is now a fully sanctified human life. This language is taken from the Aukin Institute article. So if you want more details around those things, then certainly feel free to look into that. And I included the link to that in the course syllabus. But of course, the exception to terminating a pregnancy after that 120 days would be if there is a danger to the mother's life. And so the logic behind this is a legal maxim in Islamic law that says that certainty should not be overridden by doubt. So in other words, the potential life of the infant should not threaten the stable life, that of the mother. So the mother's survivability is much more predictable. She, you know, has been alive as a healthy human, whereas the infant, as we talked about in our discussion of viability, you know, may or may not make it. And certainly even infants that are born full term, you know, for whatever reason, can die early from things such as SIDS, you know. So you prioritize the mother's life because it is more certain than that of the infant. Jurists also support this from another angle, saying that the mother is the origin of the infant. So even if they have equal possibility of surviving, as long as the fetus is part of her and dependent on her, you can't cut the root to save the branch. So those are the two angles. Any questions about that?
This is even if, let's say, the mother has specifically willed that, please save my child, and, you know, like, even if I die, just save my child. In Islam, that is not allowed, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because, I mean, presumably the mother has people in her life who know her, presumably has maybe even already had children who are reliant on her. That's a really interesting question, but
because it's a very motherly instinct, right? Like, I mean, she's already carried this baby for so long, and, you know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Let me do a little bit more digging and say, like, what can you as an individual say? I want to, like, support the life of the baby over my own life. That wasn't something that had occurred to me. So I'll look into it. Thank you for bringing that up. Anything else? Okay. So this is just a summary slide, saying that before 40 days, generally, there should be a legitimate reason. Before 120 days in certain instances with pressing need, and after 120 days, pregnancy termination should be done to save the life of the mother. But of course, in Islamic thought, there's preference to use contraception to prevent an unwanted pregnancy than to rely on abortion to remedy a problematic outcome. And so this, as we talked about in our last lecture on contraception, one of the reasons why contraception is allowed, because you would rather prevent a pregnancy than to have to make a really difficult decision about whether or not to continue something that is, like, potentially on its way to becoming a fully sanctified life. Okay. So how is abortion performed in the United States? It depends on how far along the pregnancy is. So I've divided it roughly into first trimester and second trimester. But in the first basically for either trimester, you have two options, either a medical option, meaning being given medicines, or a surgical option, meaning that the provider actually goes into the uterus and extracts the pregnancy. As far as for the first trimester, typically it's two medications that are given, one that's taken orally and then one that's placed vaginally. These can be taken at home, okay? And then the pregnancy can be passed at home. So this is an option that people may choose if they just want greater privacy, or if they want to experience the loss of the pregnancy at home. And it can be done safely up to between 10 and 11 weeks gestational age. It's FDA approved for 10 weeks, but centers like Planned Parenthood have evidence that it can be safe up to 11 weeks. And then as far as for a surgical option, it's a procedure called a suction D&C, D standing for dilation, meaning dilating the cervix, and C standing for curettage, meaning taking an instrument to remove the contents of the uterus. So this would have to be performed in a clinic. There are some clinics that have certain levels of anesthesia approval, and so they're able to perform it in a clinic setting, and certainly a clinic like Planned Parenthood, for example, would be able to provide that. And these can be performed up to about 14 weeks gestational age. And then as the patient moves into the second trimester, then certainly the procedure becomes a little bit more complicated. There's greater risk involved, particularly risk of infection and risk of hemorrhage, or risk of a retained placenta, for example, because now the structures have gotten so much bigger. So in order to undergo kind of a medical abortion, or really it can be thought of as like an induction of labor at this point, would be either multiple. There are many different ways that it can be performed in the second trimester, either through a series of medications that are given in the vagina or with IV Pitocin. So anyone who's gone through labor may have actually had Pitocin given to them even for their normal pregnancy in order for it to be delivered. And you can do that even with people who need to deliver the pregnancy earlier. So these can be given over the course of 24 to 48 hours, and they require hospitalization, again, because of the risk involved. And then some individuals may opt for a D&E, that's dilation. So again, dilating the cervix and evacuation. It refers to kind of a greater amount of tissue that needs to be extracted as opposed to the curettage. And so because, again, the risk involved, these need to be performed in either a surgery center or a hospital, a place where, if God forbid something were to happen where a blood transfusion would be needed imminently, you know, that everything would be available. Okay, so these are not just ways that we treat people who want an elective kind of abortion, but even for women who have a retained miscarriage, meaning that the pregnancy passed in the uterus, but contractions never came, or maybe they only partially evacuated the pregnancy and a part of it still remains in the uterus, then certainly they can opt for either of these two options. And as far as for the second trimester, certainly these are also methods that are used for someone who has a late fetal demise, meaning a demise in the second trimester where the baby has already passed and now needs to be delivered. So as far as kind of statistics on abortion, this is data from 2008, but 1.2 million abortions occurred in the US that year for a population of about 300 million. And 30% of US women report having an abortion by age 45, so almost a third. But second trimester abortions are actually relatively rare. Only about 10% occur after 13 weeks gestational age. 98.7% of abortions in the US are performed at 20 weeks or earlier. And this is actually relatively in line with the 19 week one day cutoff in Islam. So I just thought that was really interesting. Certainly, you know, medical providers in the US aren't trying to be in alignment with like what's kind of like proposed in Islam, but I just thought it was really fascinating that even in a place where abortions are kind of offered in, I guess, in a more secular way, still don't seem to perform them later than Islamically we would think that the soul enters the fetus. Any questions, concerns, thoughts about any of this? Okay. So these last few slides, we're going to focus on kind of descriptions of the womb in Islam. So Muslim jurists have always viewed the fetus as the precious origin of human life, and certainly it is. And the womb is perceived as a fragile vessel that carries a unique human soul and hence deserves safeguarding and careful treatment, okay? So there's a Qudsi hadith that says, that God says, I am Allah and I am Ar-Rahman, the most merciful, who created the rahim or the womb. So whoever stays connected with it, I will connect him to my mercy, and whoever severs ties with it, I will disconnect him from my mercy. I want to focus more on like the language that's used here. There's a distinct linguistic connection that's being made between the name of Allah Ar-Rahman, the most merciful, and the Rahim, the womb. So clearly these two words are derived from the word for mercy. So womb, even in the Arabic language, is considered a mercy. Either you can think of it as a mercy like for women to mankind. I just think it's so beautiful that this is the one structure in the human body that almost shares a name with one of the most beautiful attributes of Allah, one of the most frequently used names of Allah. And there's a direct connection there, which I think speaks to what a high status the womb has in the eyes of God, and like through that we as Muslims should have when we view it. I also like this surah that we had mentioned earlier from these verses from Surah Al-Mu'minun that says, and indeed we created man from a jot of clay, and then we made him a drop in a secure dwelling place. And I just find that description to be so beautiful. It almost makes me tearful in a way that, like, this is how the womb is described as a secure dwelling place. It's like, it's cozy, it's sweet, it's endearing. It is, you know, like the place where you probably felt safest in your entire life, Panalam. But does anyone have any thoughts about these words or these, these verses? Okay, so I have a few more. So these two verses from chapter 35 in the Quran and then chapter 41 have almost identical language. So this first one says, God created you from dust and from a drop, then he made you pairs, and no female bears or brings forth save with his knowledge. And none who grows old, nor has aught lessened of his life, but that it is in a book, truly that is easy for God. And similarly here, it says, unto him is knowledge of the hour referred. No fruits come forth from their sheaths, nor does any female bear or bring forth, save by his knowledge. And on the day when he will call unto them, where are my partners? They will say, we admit unto thee that none among us bears witness. So here are two surahs that are referencing the fact that Allah above all knows when conception occurs or it doesn't occur. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, the Quran talks about the pregnancy in terms of embryologic age, whereas physicians and humans talk about the pregnancy in terms of gestational age. And the reason being that as human beings, we don't really know when ovulation occurs. And even when we date these pregnancies, we're doing it based on this external sign, but ovulation can occur at any point from when the last period is, right? Like even months later for people who have really irregular periods. So it goes back to this idea that, like, even the woman who ovulates doesn't know when she's ovulating, but Allah has knowledge of this. Okay. So pairing that with this next surah, it says that God knows that which every female bears, how wombs diminish and how they increase. Everything with him is according to a measure, knower of the unseen and the seen, the great, the exalted. Okay. So the first part of this verse, I think, is beautiful because it talks about how wombs diminish and how they increase. I think this can be seen in a couple of ways. One way is that the uterus can grow from less than the size of your fist up to an organ that reaches up to just underneath your rib cage. So the womb itself has, when it's fully pregnant, has enough blood flow that the entire circulation of blood in a person's body goes through the uterus within 10 minutes when someone is full term. Imagine how large of a structure this is, and that it can accommodate so much of the entire human body's capacity for blood. And then after delivery, it just shrinks back down. No other organ in the human body undergoes this kind of transformation, or undergoes it so many times in life, depending on how often the person gets pregnant, even if they miscarry or if they have a full term or, you know, a preterm pregnancy. So first it shows you the amount of respect that the womb kind of commands, because no other organ can do what it does and transform the way that it does. I think another way that this can also be thought of is that, you know, how wombs diminish and how they increase. I think some interpretations of that, it's also maybe a reference to how women can miscarry, which again is another reassurance from Allah that, you know, underlining that this is actually really common, and that it's within his control. That's the first thing that I really like about this. And then the next part is going back to this idea that Allah is the knower of the unseen and the seen. And in Arabic, and excuse me, because my Arabic is not very good, but it's alam al-ghayb wal-shahada. Alam al-ghayb, he knows the unseen, and the word for unseen is al-ghayb in this instance, okay? And then I think of this, and I pair it with this other verse in the Quran, which is actually a really, I don't know if controversial is the right word for it, but it's a verse that I think people talk a lot and reflect a lot about. And I found so many interpretations and even just so many translations for this verse. But I put the full verse here. So it's from Surah An-Nisa. It says that men are the caretakers of women, as men have been provisioned by Allah over women and tasked with supporting them financially. And righteous women are devoutly obedient and, when alone, protective of what Allah has entrusted them with. And so this part in yellow that I've highlighted corresponds to this portion in yellow. So the part that says that they are protective of what Allah has entrusted them with, they are hafizat lil ghaib, bima hafaza Allah. They are protective or preservers of the unseen. And it's interesting because in the translation, there isn't actually the words unseen used here, but it's actually the same word that we saw here previously in these verses that are directly talking about the womb, right? So to me, this is saying that women are protective of this unseen thing. And what is it that's unseen? It's not just the conception that's unseen, but it's also the ensoulment. SubhanAllah, this is the organ that which connects the earth to the heavens. Allah creates a soul and He imparts it into a woman's womb. And I just think that that is so incredible that our bodies have the capability to do something like that, that our uterus is actually directly connected to Allah. And responsible for housing this unborn life, for we are entrusted by God to protect this, like the womb itself, to protect the pregnancy, to protect like the soul that enters it. It is such like an incredible responsibility and an incredible privilege that we're given, because we're born with this organ that only half of humanity has. So that's the way that I interpret this. Does anyone have any thoughts about this, or about other verses, or just about anything that we've talked about so far?
That's a really profound reflection. I really appreciate you expounding on that. I think I'm really enjoying and appreciating the number of verses that are being highlighted here, and the many themes that we're seeing, or even phrases and specific words that are repeated, and the ones that are new or unique to certain verses.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just think it's so incredible. And it's actually like this, the substance of this lecture are what made me want to make this course. It just gives me chills every time. And it's so like tragic to me that in you know, what's kind of called like Western feminism, or that women are actually, they constantly seeking out what men have. Like, if a man wears pants, I would wear pants. And if a man does this, then I want to do this. But actually, like, we're totally missing that we have this incredible thing that we're given. And certainly, like, not everyone can get pregnant or bear children for whatever reason. And it's not about that, but it's about just like respecting the difference that women have from men, and the different rights and the different responsibilities, and that we don't need to derive like our own self-worth relative to a man's, but actually Allah is like continuously addressing us and addressing the things that make us unique, because like He loves us individually, like not relative to men. He loves us as human beings, but also humans that He imparted like this particular gift with. And so it just gives me so much like a calmness of mind that like I don't need to be seeking out what anyone else has. Like I can just be in awe and appreciation of the way that Allah created me, whether, you know, it's because of my womb or like anything else that makes me unique or anybody unique.
Right. And I'm thinking too, with your comments on, you know, the danger of always lionizing or idolizing what men have, or the ambitions of men, versus perhaps the task here is elevating the sacred beauty of the feminine and making that something to aspire towards as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree, Sophia.
I'd also like to point out that the verse on do not kill children out of poverty and the whole imlak word, that's definitely new to me and maybe to a lot of people as well, because of we've just only heard the English translation of it's just poverty, and it's being said and reiterated in cases where, you know, with families who have less wealth and all that, you know, and they have sure, children are a blessing, but they're also worried, you know, how am I going to provide for them, right? So it's this, I mean, it's a very, very new thing for me to hear that, you know, oh, like, I guess wealthy people also have this fear, I guess, of losing material wealth.
And they seem to have it more.
So,
sorry, I interrupted you.
No. Yeah, so that was a new thing that I learned from your explanation of that verse. And also how, as you said, linguistically, Rahim and the Raham itself, so ever since joining like tafsir classes and whatnot, and learning on the name of, you know, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, so every time I say Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, even in prayer, I always remember the womb and therefore my mother, and that is my first, you know, experience of love, I guess. So as much as my mother loves me and as much as I love my child, God loves me more, and to have to be able to be privileged enough to know a mother's love that way, and now to have my own child to feel that love towards, it's just unimaginable to me, that amount of love that my creator has for me. And how like the Raham envelops you and like, you know, protects you, surrounds you, and, you know, gives you such a warm hug, you know. So that visualization that I have really helps me with khushu' in salat.
Ah, that's so beautiful. I can't even imagine. I don't have like children of my own, and certainly we can all like reflect on the way that our mothers love us, but I think kind of like you alluded to, like it's like you don't even really realize how profound it is, maybe until you experience it yourself, even. And to think that Allah loves you even more than you love your child, like unimaginable. Yeah, it's really beautiful. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, that's basically all I have. So inshallah, in 2 weeks, I believe the next course is on infertility, if I remember correctly. And so that's another one that I'm also really looking forward to. And I appreciate, again, you guys always joining me. So inshallah, we'll see you then. I hope you didn't stay up too late.
It's okay. My baby just went to sleep. So perfect timing.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Assalamu alaikum, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Bye-bye.